everyone, and welcome to another exciting edition of the Great American Senior Show. In our previous episode, Dr. Modi Ramgopal discussed COVID-21. We pick up the conversation and learn why COVID-21 is a new name with new importance.
One of the things that, and I forget where I read it, I'm a voracious reader. My wife says if you subscribe to one more newspaper, they're going to find you in the driveway instead of the newspaper. Yeah. But you've used the term COVID-21. How did that term come about?
So because in the last 3 months, I mean, you look back, it was settling. COVID-19 was the original variant of coronavirus, and that was a totally different virus, the way it behaves to the current virus. So the virus is mutated, it's now become a Delta strain, as we call it. The WHO classifies it, depending on the Greek alphabet, as a Delta strain. But when you look at the clinical behavior of this virus, it's a lot different from COVID-19. COVID-19, when you look at the mortality, the morbidity numbers, even though it spread, it didn't spread as much as this virus. It doesn't replicate as the Delta strain. And when I look at what I've seen in the last 4 to 6 weeks in the hospital, it's a different story. It's a harder and a tougher story. When I'm seeing 25-year-olds and 30-year-olds and 35-year-olds and 40-year-olds really, truly sick. COVID-19, a year and a half ago, we saw the elderly. We saw a lot in the 70s and 80s and the late 60s. We didn't see the 30s and 40-year-olds now. And I'm seeing these patients become very infected very quickly, and they progress very quickly. They could be breathing fine now, and 6 hours later, they're on the ventilator. Like just today, that happened to a patient of mine. This morning, he woke up, he's been hardly in any oxygen, ready to be discharged, and boom, he's intubated now. We're discussing hospice with him and his family, and he's only 50 years old.
Wow.
I just saw a 23-year-old patient just collapse yesterday, requiring intubation. This was not what we saw two years ago. We're seeing younger children with asthmatics, obesity. But the thing that really is consistent between the two, COVID-19 and 21, is that obesity remains a dominant story. And then as well as diabetes. But the younger generation and the behavior of this new virus is somewhat a lot different from the original variants that came out of Wuhan. And I think that's why I'm calling it. But I think that if you keep calling it COVID-19, people say, oh, that's a weaker virus. Saying it's COVID-21 really emphasized the fact that this is behaving differently. It's a much more aggressive virus. It's a deadly virus if you don't have any treatment. Sure, we're using remdesivir. Sure, we're using steroids. Sure, we're using every other, you know, IL-6 inhibitors, JK inhibitors. Without those, a lot more people would probably be dying.
To me, it is amazing that what you just said is that people look at it, and in many cases, I think they go, oh, that's old. Yeah. It's not old. It is brand new. And they make a conscious majority of who are infected, if I'm reading the statistics correctly, the majority of the infected are unvaccinated. What has to be going through their minds?
So the question of vaccination and unvaccination has been an overarching enemy for the vaccination story for 50 years. Even going back to the time of polio, when we said, okay, you need to be vaccinated, there's always that resistance. There's a natural resistance to change by people. And here's something new. What do we do that's different? And so even I would tell patients over time, I said, you know, December when the vaccine story was out and here's the clinical trial and research, I had to see it for myself. I had my questions, I had my doubts. But now, why should you doubt something that is incredibly effective? When I ask patients on the daily, on each patient, did you get your vaccine? And the constant answer is no, no, no. And very once in a, infrequently, I'll have one person who said yes, they had their two vaccine and they have mild symptoms. That's what is expected to do. But I don't think we predicted or understood that the impact of the vaccine would be so tremendous. I don't think that in January and February that we would have said in August that 99% of people who are unvaccinated would now be in the hospital. So again, COVID-21 is a pandemic of the unvaccinated, is a pandemic of the Delta strain, is a pandemic of misinformation, is where people are hearing what they want to hear in social media platform and take that information and then they amplify it. And then they amplify treatment strategies that has no data. And then they're saying that the treatment that has data is not good enough for them. But the question is, I keep pondering and I keep asking, you know, patients is that where did we go wrong? where was the misinformation coming from? Why is it that the anti-vaxxers can have such a greater influence on you than we can with all the data and the resource and the science we have? Why is the science so difficult to understand and believe? Is it because we're not translating it right, in the right way? You know what was interesting? I had this patient in the hospital, and this is a recurrent story now, is that they're saying, do I have pneumonia? I said, yes, you have pneumonia from COVID. COVID gives pneumonia? So here's 2021, and patients are asking a simple question. Can I get pneumonia from COVID? And this is not, these are well-educated people who have been in this healthcare system, and the data and information has been there for 2 years now. So where are we missing this communication? What are we doing wrong is the question.
And I think that's a very valid question. As a member of, a former member of the media, and to a large extent, I still am a member of the media for some 35, 40 years, I think, and I'll share this as an opinion because I can now, doing podcasts as compared to being a very neutral person of broadcast news, I think people want to believe what they want to believe. And that is a fact that they're not going to defer one way or the other. This is what I believe. I'm going to reach out and gather the things that support my belief and be damned with everything else, even to the point of it kills me.
I completely agree with that statement because there are patients who will say, well, I didn't take the vaccine because it's not FDA approved. Well, here, it's FDA approved now. Let's see what's going to happen. And I would like, and I would probably have be of the opinion that about 50% of those will probably still not take it.
Yes.
Because they'll find another reason.
Yeah. But we don't have FDA approval for cowwormer, horsewormer, but they are willing to take that.
Yeah, that's I'm pretty sure you're describing ivermectin. And that's a story I keep hearing every single day. And so when we rewind back to a year ago, just over a year ago, when it was researched that, okay, here are many similar, as we call them, that can work against coronavirus, but recognizing that these are weak antivirals. My fear about using weak antiviral is like telling someone, here's half a pill of AZT, see if it works today in HIV. That's the comparison I like to explain to patients. We know ivermectin has some antiviral activity, but it is considered a very, very weak antiviral. When you look at the dosage required and the viral killing and the viral kinetics, it's not, but even though you try to explain it in a way that it makes sense, you still get, I want ivermectin. Like a patient said, my brother is sick in the ICU in a ventilator, can you give him ivermectin? And I said, but there's no data. But when you look at the countries which use ivermectin quite extensively, we saw India use it a lot. We saw Peru use it a lot. And what have we seen? Here's the Delta variant. Here's the Lambda variant. Is there a relationship? Can you now use weaker agents and then develop resistance or different variants? That's a good question.
But in those countries, isn't that sort of a false positive because there isn't a true connection between the type of virus that we have versus something that is either larval or otherwise transmitted? Is that they're getting a false positive out of that, aren't they?
Yes, there are. I mean, there's no good substance in there, and there are multiple studies that have been done, and hasn't shown anything to be excited about. I think as an infectious disease physician, you want to be excited about medication that work, that you can see the data, like we were with the heart, with the HIV treatment strategies. And even now with HIV treatment, when you look at what's going on with HIV treatment now, we went from multiple pills twice a day to single pill once a day. Now we're going into injections every month, then injections every 6 months, and then once a year. So when we look at research and strategies, why is it we still don't have the confidence in the science and the data? Yet we've been bringing new drugs to the market every year, every month, periodically. That is changing the world. But yet, science is telling you don't do this, but society is driving that story. But science has demonstrated over and over again how successful we are in developing drugs. Drug development is such an incredible and fascinating story when you look back at the history of it.
Indeed it is. For those of us that, and I am not a part of the medical community other than I have clients who are in it and I have interest in urgent care and that's a passion, but it seems like we've been in this forever as far as COVID is concerned, but really we're only looking at a year and a half. So is it too early to look and say, what is the long-term effect, even for those that have the mild COVID What's the long-term effect going to be?
So the long-term effect of COVID is going to be very complex, and it varies from the body, the whole patient as a whole, and it will include mental health. And so when we look right now at the severely infected patients, the obesity, the diabetes, we need to address those questions. We have got to this part because of what has happened over the last 20 to 30 years. And then moving forward, what's it going to look like? We're going to have to address a lot of issues. Obesity again, diabetes again. And then we're going to have to address issues like here's going to be new variants. What's it going to look like a year from now? How long can we continue with this periodic being hit 6 weeks, every 3 or 4 months, new strain, new news, new alarm, new confusion, can't go to work. My children may get infected now. My parents are infected, my grand. So there's constant stress and turmoil, mental stress. You know what's one of the quite interesting things I see when I look at COVID patients that are going to a room? The fear. See a lot of fear in patients. And this is within 24 to 48 hours of being infected. And the more I recognize this virus doesn't just affect the lungs, it affects the mind. It's quite mind-numbing to see patients with just fear in their face. Are they going to live or not? Even though, are they going to see their family again? Are they going to go home? So we're seeing a bunch of syndromes as they're evolving, the COVID long haul syndrome, the chronic lung problems, this COVID fog syndrome, where mentally they take quite a while to recover. I've seen those patients. And now we're looking at October, when we've reduced our mask wearing, here's the flu season coming around, here's a Delta strain still lingering in the background, and now you have flu season, and then next year there may be new variants. So the next 6 months, a year, we're still not out of the woods. I remember writing about this a year ago, that this is a long tunnel, and we can't give up. What's going to really be the game changer? And I said this a while ago, the vaccines are good. They're good for control. They're very impressive for reducing transmission, everything else. But I think what's ultimately will be the game changer is treatment strategies. Like we're beginning to see now, the monoclonal antibodies, the availability of that, injection, the infusion. But I think once we get to a pill form, once you can say somebody has COVID, here's pills, 5 days, that's when I truly believe a pill that will stop the virus. In this track, we see that not having antibodies to stop the virus is one mechanism, but actually a medication that will kill the virus. Reducing replication, reducing the transmission is where we need to be. And how far are we from that? Probably about 6 months a year. There were several drugs in the pipeline.
That was absolutely my next question. You mentioned something, and I'll go back a short time here, maybe 30 seconds ago, 45 seconds ago, about the social structure. And I keep coming back to World Health Organization because I tune into them constantly and monitor them. They have just, and I'm speaking to the choir, I'm sure, launched a decade-long study of isolationism and loneliness as it predominantly refers to our seniors, because many of them have been isolated, alone in assisted living facilities, skilled nursing facilities, various care facilities, even in their own homes to a large extent, isolated. And that is having an impact on the social structure that ultimately leads to other problems, medical, mental, and physical problems.
So on a personal level, I've actually seen this happen in my household. My parents, my mom, 82 years old, and because of my involvement in COVID, she had to move to live with my brother. And that distance, and in the last year, I've seen her dementia progress much faster than I would have expected. I've seen her mood change, and I'm pretty sure this is what we were seeing universally. So when you look, recognize patients, they're watching television, the social interaction, the lack of affection with their grandkids, and even the emotional contact, it's been challenged right now. Whereas before we'd be warm and hugging, now we're creating this social distancing, we're wearing a mask, even though that's such important and relevant and necessary. The question of what's going to happen in the next 2 or 3 years and how quickly are we going to get back to reversing that story? So the loneliness with the elderly is going to be an interesting. And then what's going to happen to the children now who are going to school with masks? Is this going to be PTSD for them 10, 15 years from now, remembering those days when they had to wear masks to go to school? And the question with their children's social interaction. So it's a really going to be a long 10 years ahead of us. It reminds me of the Second World War pretty much. here's a huge, you know, the world has went into a real change. Yes. And then the impact of that war remained for the next 20 years.
And I think PTSD among those in the medical community is totally, even now, off the chart. And we haven't even seen the worst of it, in my opinion.
So it is, you're correct. You're completely correct. So it's really off the chart. I remember going into the ICU less than a week ago, and there were two nurses just crying. And they're crying because of this young 24-year-old patient who just had a baby, was pretty much on the ventilator. And you can see the pain and suffering in the unit, seeing patients every day. Yesterday, you know, 3-4 patients died, and it's wearing on us. It's wearing on every single healthcare worker. And I think what frustrates us is when we go into the patient room and they say, oh, I didn't take the vaccine, and I'm not going to take a vaccine. I don't believe in vaccines. And yet they're in the hospital waiting for a cure, and these numbers are adding up. And I think that stress on us has been continuous. It's been a year and a half of this for us as healthcare workers. Some people say, well, at least you have a job. It's not just a job anymore. It's an emotional connection. And to say that you have patients and you're not emotionally connected is not a true statement. I think every provider, nurses, physicians, we connect to our patients. I think without that connection, we wouldn't be very good physicians or healthcare workers.
I totally agree. And it shows. It absolutely shows. Shift gears, though, for just a moment. You founded a 501c3 organization. That is where we are today. Tell us about the organization itself.
So I moved to Fort Pierce about 21 years ago. And when I moved to St. Lucie County, we had the highest number of HIV in the state of Florida. And little did I know that Fort Pierce is probably one of the lowest socioeconomic areas. I had no clue when I moved here. But what I just looked at the map of Florida. I said, I'm going to move here. So arriving here 21 years ago and recognized that HIV was an issue, and my patients who lived in Fort Pierce were not have access to new medications, not even have access to food and transportation, and the social challenge we face with HIV. So I think as an organization, I had a really good group of us together. We sat down, we started this nonprofit, and our mission was to provide care for patients who don't have access. Like, for example, I've never turned away a patient in the 21 years I've been practicing. For insurance reasons, for financial reasons, I think it's a gift from God to be a physician. It's a gift for all of us to be healthcare workers and whatever we do. And I truly believe that if I do that, I will be fulfilling the calling I have. So providing healthcare service to every single person, diabetic, uninsured, over 65, whoever you are, HIV, I think was the purpose of this organization. And I said, if we can do this right, we'll do something very special. And thankfully, we've been doing it right for several years now, and it's becoming very exciting to be part of this group. Because I look at HIV, for example, and the question is, why did St. Lucie County have such a highest rate? There are many physicians. You go to Dade County, for example, there's over 200 infectious disease physicians there. But yet, Miami-Dade has among the highest in the state, in the country. Why? Because most of the physicians you see today are seeing insured patients. Who are the ones taking care of the uninsured? Where's the social challenges of healthcare? It's usually with the low socioeconomic group, the uninsured. HIV spreads faster in the more common age in the Medicaid community. Uninsured patients, you know, needle issues, drug substance abuse issues. And the same thing with obesity, the same thing with diabetes. They all will fall into this socioeconomic group. And when you look at most physicians, oh, I want to just do insured patients. So where does this group of patients fall under? They fall into this chasm of emptiness where they don't get really, really good quality care. So that's what Midway decided to set up. We're going to do this. We're going to go to tough communities. And I think the long-term vision is to use technology, use how do we get into people's head? How do we get into their cell phones? How do we get into their world? To address the healthcare needs, if it's obesity, if it's diabetes, if it's transportation issues, if it's the mental health issues, how can we connect to them very quickly and capture that story? We've provided services for substance abuse patients, for sexual abuse victims. We see them very quickly in our office, start them post-exposure prophylaxis, engage them, make patients feel they're not just a patient, not just a body, but as a person. Transition that whole mindset of healthcare, whereby you're just not a number, but you're an identity. You're a person sitting in front of me with fears, with challenges, with questions. And I need to fix those questions before you leave here. And the reason for that is because If patients don't feel that way, they're not going to take their medications. They're not going to remain in care. They'll feel disillusioned and give up on themselves.
Before I leave, I want to touch on an area. We've covered a wide variety, and I'm very conscious of your availability and your time today. But when I said this was your world headquarters, you also have outreach in Guyana.
Yes, I do. So my lifelong vision was always to go back to Guyana and start a clinic there. I started working for PEPFAR under Dr. Redfield's guidance in the late 2008-2009. That was an incredible program. So having been involved with Guyana during this period of time, I've recently established an infectious disease clinic there, and then as well as one in Trinidad. And my goal is that here's the Caribbean, here's Guyana. Guyana's part of South America. These are countries where you can have an emerging disease from very quickly, like chikungunya, like, you know, Junin virus or some hemorrhagic fever. You can be a plane in Guyana or somewhere in the Caribbean and be in the US the next day. Yes. So, but there's no networking. There's no understanding that here, how do we bring that quality care again to undeserved communities? That's the question. Can you transcend this? Here, I've been living in the United States for 30 years now, and I've seen what we can do here. Can we now take a piece of that and improve the quality of care in countries? But not just the care of the patients, include the quality of the physicians as well. There are really, really smart physicians there, but they don't have a PCR machine. They don't have MRIs and CTs as we have so much available. They have laparoscopic surgery. They may have one or two cardiologists in the entire country. So how can we now get echocardiogram results? How can we provide oncology treatment? So the vision for Midway in the Caribbean is to provide improved quality and find treatment strategies as well as educational opportunities for physicians to bring physicians up, get them into research, train about research, writing papers, publications, and even getting into deeper research projects as well.
I admire what you are doing, where you have been, and where you are going. Before we wrap the program up, any last thoughts that you would like to leave with our audience?
Yes, I think we're in the midst of a global pandemic. We're in the midst of very challenging times. I think that we need to reassess our values. Like I told someone recently, what if I was to tell you in 6 months from now, as bad as it is today, it would be worse. What would you do different today? How would you recalibrate your life? Would you recalibrate it spiritually? Would you calibrate it financially? Would you recalibrate it with your family? Would you regret things 6 months from now that you didn't do today? So it's a message I will say loud and clear. Rethink what we're doing on a daily basis. Remembering that it can get worse before it gets better. We have gone halfway down this tunnel. We're not at the end of the tunnels yet. And to recognize the fact that we need to continue the thing working and the things that worked before, social distancing, masking. And when you look at the noise in the community and the noise on Facebook and social media platforms and the noise on the television station, you need to learn as an individual to separate the noise from facts. There's a lot of access to data and understanding the clinical data and clinical science. Reach out to those areas, ask the questions, but ask the question in a scientific way. Don't bring the politics into it. Don't bring the emotional story into it. Ask the question in a scientific way. And I think you'll find the right answers that will guide you about vaccines and guide you about treatment decisions, guide you about where we need to be in the next 6 months to a year to get through this pandemic. This pandemic, I still believe, is truly something very unusual, very frightening. The virus continues to mutate. The virus is very concerning. We have a tough winter ahead of us, and heading into the summer next year, we need to be very careful we don't lose our nerve, we don't lose our emotional mindset that we will get through this, and we need to be strong about it, and we need to be determined and have a focus in our mind and strategy to do this.
Right. Great advice. One final question. Would you be back on our program again in the future?
If you invite me, sure.
Absolutely. That's a standing invitation. And Jana is going to get that phone call. So she's going to, you know, go, okay, we'll take care of that. Again, I appreciate you being here. The Great American Senior Show, we attempt to bring people and topics to the forefront so that we can do many of the things that you were just talking about. Keep them informed and keep them in a rational line of thinking. I'm Sam Yates, your gray-haired host for the Great American Senior Show. And that's the way our program ends.